this problem of censorship and obscenity. There is legislation pending on the state and on the national level. Many sincere and dedicated people say that something has to be done. This amount of increase in obscene literature and pornographic literature must not continue. And yet the American Civil Liberties Union has taken a stand as in one simple statement here that the American Civil Liberties Union opposes all prior censorship of what people may see, read, or hear. Now, if you want a detailed statement, the bulletin is out on the table in the entryway. The Minnesota affiliate, the board, feels that it might well evaluate and reevaluate its position. And to help the board and to help all friends of civil liberties think through on this problem, we have assembled tonight four very well qualified and able people to present different aspects of this problem. Now I'm going to tell you who they are, the order in which they'll speak. We have changed the order a little from what you received in your news. I'll tell you about them, and then one will follow the other. First to speak tonight is John French. He's a Minneapolis attorney. He was formerly a clerk for the late Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter. Now, Mr. French will set the stage for our discussion by talking about the constitutional standards that surround the censorship of obscenity, and also perhaps some of the recent court rulings. He will be followed then by Gordon Haskell, who comes to us from our national office. He's on the staff as director of the membership and the development department. Now he will explain the position that the American Civil Liberties Union has taken on this controversial problem, will give you some of the historical development and some of the thinking on the national picture. Then Professor Edward Gerald will talk. He's from the School of Journalism at the University of Minnesota. He's author of a book, The Social Responsibility of the Press. Now, he will tend to present the point of view of moderation of the position taken by the American Civil Liberties Union. And then to close the discussion will be a member of our board, friend most of us, Dr. Reynold Jensen. He's director of child psychiatry at the University Hospitals. He will attempt to answer the question that the American Civil Liberties Union has been asking for a long time. Has there been a scientific study made on the causal factors of obscene literature and antisocial behavior? And perhaps suggest some things that we all might do. Now, with that introduction then, may I call first on Mr. French.
Good evening. My happy task this evening is to try to outline the constitutional standards that form the framework for the discussion of censorship and obscenity. As I'm sure you understand, this topic presents its problems. The law has, on different occasions, been called a lot of different things. It's been called a jealous mistress and a seamless web, and so on and so forth. In the area that we're discussing, I think it might be called a will-o'-the-wisp. It's very difficult to define and more difficult to grasp. I don't mean to create the impression that this is peculiar. For one thing, the law in this area is very new. The Roth case, which is a landmark on this subject, was only decided in 1957, and it takes a good while for any subject of law, even a less controversial subject, to shake down and develop some firm guidelines. Beyond that, however, you should keep in mind that this is constitutional law, and there is often not very much law in the traditional sense in constitutional law. It's law, I suppose, because judges are required to make judgments about it in courts but the content is often politics or theology or economics, and the controversial nature is clear. In any event, with respect to constitutional law, I remember remarking to Justice Frankfurter once that a law teacher had told me that the way the Supreme Court was reversing its prior decisions, there wasn't going to be any law left to teach, and all he would be able to teach would be the biographies of the justices. And the justice looked at me and said, "I never taught it any other way." You may find that a little cynical when applied to this topic, and I think he was stretching a point. But the fact is that here there is some reason to try to probe what the justices think as much as you try to probe what the law is or is not. In the first place, many of the cases in this area are decided per curiam, that is, by the court as a whole in the form of an order without an opinion attached. So you know what the result was, but you don't know the reasons. In many of the other cases, instead of following the customary format, having an opinion for the court and perhaps a dissent, perhaps no dissent, you find that there isn't any opinion for the court. There is a result, but one of the justices announces an opinion in which one or two others concur, and then perhaps three of them write separate concurrences, and one or two write dissents. And the result is that you don't know what the law of the case is. You know what each different justice thought about the case. So my approach to this problem will be to try to state, so far as I can, what I think the law is, and when I bog down, to supply what I think the justices think, which in the last analysis will ultimately provide the standards. There are two main subjects here, it seems to me. The first is, what is obscenity in the mind of the court? And the second is, once you've defined obscenity, what may you or may you not do about it? Now, approaching the first, the basic position is one that I think I can state with some confidence, because ever since the Roth and Alberts cases, 1957, there has been a consistent majority opinion. It's been a shifting majority, but a consistent majority, for the proposition that obscenity, whatever that may be, is not a protected expression within the First and 14th Amendments. According to the court in the Roth case, the original framers of the Constitution did not intend to encompass obscenity in the protection of free speech, since they deemed obscenity, as the court put it, utterly without redeeming social importance. Now I have said everything that I can say, I think, about what the law is on obscenity, and I will embark into what the justices think about the problem. First and easiest are Justices Black and Douglas, who think that what I have just told you is wrong. They think that obscenity, whatever it is expression like any other form of expression and entitled to the same protections. And as they put it, they would leave it to the judgment of the people to reject noxious literature in the same manner that they leave it to the judgment of the people to reject false theology or politics or economics. In all these cases, Justices Black and Douglas sometimes concur with a majority when it reverses a conviction, but they consistently state this separate concurrence also. Next, I think we can lump Justices Brennan, Goldberg, and White. Their view is, as I have said, that obscenity is without redeeming social importance and therefore not protected. To find out what is obscene, the test that they apply is whether or not the material is such that its dominant appeal, taken as a whole, is to the prurient interest. Isn't that nice? Now, as to what the prurient interest may be, there is some difficulty. There are expressions in opinions which indicate that a dominant appeal to the prurient interest would be an appeal to an exacerbated, morbid, or perverted interest in sex, or a tendency to arouse lustful thoughts, or to corrupt or deprave. The justices I'm describing recognize and have said so in a recent opinion that this is something less than a perfect verbalization of what they have in mind, but they don't think there's a better one, so they're going to stick with it. The test which they would apply is whether or not the material goes substantially beyond the customary limits of candor according to contemporary community standards. And they're quite clear that these standards must be national rather than local in order to preserve uniform application of the rule throughout the country. Justice Stewart, I think, agrees substantially with what I've just said about Justice Brennan and his colleagues, but he's considerably more explicit. He says that he thinks the gist of the cases and commentaries is that only, quote, hardcore pornography, close quote, is obscene. Now, he admits that he may not ever be able to define what hardcore pornography is, but he says, I know it when I see it. And that's his test. Justice Harlan also is in substantial agreement about the general principles with Justice Brennan, but he adds an important variation. He thinks that the authority of state governments should be different from the authority of federal governments in the regulation of obscenity. This is one of the rare occasions when a Supreme Court justice thinks the state should have more power than the federal government. He believes that the state has customarily had an interest in protecting its citizens from various personal sorts of offenses, and that this is a kind of legislation that might profitably be conducted by the states in accordance with the old Justice Brandeis theory that the states are laboratories for social experiment, and that what one may want to do, another may not. He thinks, on the other hand, that the federal interest in regulating pornographic material is much less strong, and that the dangers of a uniform national rule are much greater. So he'd make this distinction. He also concedes that the formulation of the principle is very difficult. He says, in truth, the matter in the last analysis depends on how particular challenged material happens to strike the minds of jurors or judges, and ultimately those of a majority of this court. Finally, the Chief Justice and Justice Clark also adhere to this general test of dominant appeal to the prurient interest, but they would rely more on local community standards. They assert that there's no such thing as a national standard of what offends the consensus of the community, and they would look to local standards, and they would leave the decision largely to local juries and judges, subject only to a requirement that the record of the trial contain some significant evidence that the material was obscene. Well, in sum, I think the point to be made is that you really can't tell what the law is by listening to rules stating or attempting to state what it is. The only way you can really get at the problem is to see how the cases have been decided, not what the court has said, but what the court has done. Toward that end, here are a few of the many examples of kinds of cases that have been decided. I note that in each of these cases, the material was held not obscene, therefore not censorable. One case involved a French motion picture called The Game of Love. To quote a summary of that, This picture starts with an episode in which a 16-year-old boy is shown completely nude on a bathing beach in the presence of a group of younger girls as a result of a boating accident. And the picture goes on to depict a series of illicit sexual relations both with an older woman and a girl of his own age. In another case, the subject was a magazine called One, the homosexual magazine. This magazine appeared to have been composed without any scientific purpose and solely to appeal to the tastes and interests of homosexuals. A third case involved a magazine called Sunshine and Health, which is a nudist magazine, and which the lower court found obscene simply because it was too revealing. In all these cases, I remind you, the material was held not obscene. And I think what this demonstrates is that the court's understanding of obscenity is very, very narrow. These cases, plus a couple of other things, lead to this conclusion. For one thing, the Roth case, which was, as I've said, the leading case in this area, involved confiscation of materials by the post office. And although the materials themselves weren't the subject matter before the court, it was a more abstract question. The Solicitor General argued that about 90% of all materials seized by the post office are what would be called hardcore pornography. And to make his point, he shipped boxes and boxes of the stuff up to the court so it could circulate around and be seen by the justices so they'd know the kind of thing they were dealing with. It seems very likely that this sort of thing was in the mind of the court when it was working on the case. It comes out in the opinion also when you find the court describing obscene material as material utterly without a redeeming social importance. I think the overall suggestion is that Justice Stewart is right and that whatever the judges say about the matter, only hardcore pornography is going to be held obscene. Now, this gives us another definitional problem, hardcore pornography. But there has been some good thought and writing on this subject, the best, I think, by Dean Lockhart and Professor McClure here at the University of Minnesota Law School. They come to the conclusion, based on fairly deep study, that this probably refers to what they call daydream material, divorced from reality, whose main function is to nourish erotic fantasies of the sexually immature. They would go on to vary the standard somewhat and say that we must deal here not with material which is simply obscene in the abstract, but material which is treated as pornographic. Therefore, they would vary the result of the case depending on the audience that the material was aimed at. If somebody sold arguably obscene material to a scientific institution, they would hold that it was not treated as pornographic and therefore not censorable. On the other hand, if they sold it through an outlet that was erected in a shanty by the neighborhood junior high school, they would hold that it was directed to such an audience that it should be held pornographic. I might add that there is some recent encouragement for differentiation between material directed at adults and material directed at children. In the most recent opinion, the Jacobellis case, Justice Brennan goes out of his way to invite the states to draft statutes aimed particularly at preventing distribution to children rather than adults. Well, that, I think, in a nutshell, covers the question of what is obscene material. Now, very quickly, what may be done about it? Here the debate has been over the distinction between prior restraint and other methods of suppression. This started in a case called Near against Minnesota in 1931. This state had a statute which made any malicious, scandalous, or defamatory newspaper or other periodical subject to injunction from further publication as a nuisance. When the case got to the Supreme Court, it held the statute invalid as an unjustifiable prior restraint on publication of the paper. The difficulties were pointed up immediately in Justice Butler's dissent. He said he didn't understand how this could be prior restraint since the newspaper had already been published. As he understood it, prior restraint had to do with submitting something to a censor first and never getting it before the public at any time. That's where the battle lines have been drawn ever since. The result in Near against Minnesota does not mean that all restraints are unconstitutional. In a case called Kingsley Books, the court approved a procedure whereby material might be condemned and confiscated if it was found obscene, so long as future distribution of the same kind of material wasn't restrained. In other words, the state addressed itself only to the specific subject matter of the litigation, and the bookseller could run the risk of peddling the same thing again and having it confiscated. And in the Times Film case in 1961, the court held that in the abstract, and it was very abstract, it could not be said that no state requirement of submission of films to some administrative agency for examination prior to exhibition would definitely be bad. They permitted this kind of prior censorship and said that there, under some circumstances, surely it will be lawful. We won't say it's unlawful per se. On the other hand, there was a very strong four-man dissent in the Times Film case, and Times Film has been quite sharply restricted in a series of cases since that time, which I won't trouble you with here, except the last. The last case, called Friedman against Maryland, was decided only 6 weeks ago, and the holding there is that any censorship system must place the burden of proving obscenity on the censor, and it must provide for a speedy judicial determination of the question. In other words, a censor can't take a movie, announce that he believes it to be obscene, and therefore will not license it, and leave it to the exhibitor of the film to take the case to court and proceed through tedious and sometimes excessively time-consuming steps in order to get this judgment reversed. Where we stand on this question, I think, then, is back about at the position of the dissent in Times Film, namely that there can't be any sanctions imposed without a prior adjudication in a court. And for the reasons why we have probably ended up here, I will refer to the dissent in Times Film and read you a few excerpts. First, here are the kinds of censorship instances that were brought to the attention of the court and caused the four-man dissent to find the dangers of censorship so great. A revelation of the extent to which censorship has recently been used in this country is indeed astonishing. The Chicago licensors have banned newsreel films of Chicago policemen shooting at labor pickets and have ordered the deletion of a scene depicting the birth of a buffalo in Walt Disney's Vanishing Prairie. Before World War II, the Chicago censor denied licenses to a number of films portraying and criticizing life in Nazi Germany, including The March of Times inside Nazi Germany. Recently, Chicago refused to issue a permit for the exhibition of the motion picture Anatomy of a Murder, based upon the best-selling novel of the same title, because it found the use of the words rape and contraceptive to be objectionable. The Memphis censors banned The Southerner, which dealt with poverty among tenant farmers, because it reflects on the South. No Way Out, the story of a Negro doctor's struggle against race prejudice,
was banned by the Chicago censor on the ground that there's a possibility it could cause trouble. The principal objection to the film was that the conclusion showed no reconciliation between blacks and whites. The ban was lifted after a storm of protest and later deletion of a scene showing Negroes and whites arming for a gang fight. Memphis banned Curly because it contained scenes of white and Negro children in school together. The New York censors banned Damaged Lives, a film dealing with venereal disease, although it treated a difficult theme with dignity and had the sponsorship of the American Social Hygiene Society. The picture of Lenin's tomb bearing the inscription, "Religion is the opiate of the people," was excised from Potemkin. From Joan of Arc, the Maryland board eliminated Joan's exclamation as she stood at the stake, "O God, why hast thou forsaken me?" And from Idiot's Delight, the sentence, "We, the workers of the world, will take care of that." Professor Mamlock was produced in Russia and portrayed the prosecution of the Jews by Nazis. The Ohio censors condemned it as harmful and calculated to stir up hatred and ill will and gain nothing. It was released only after substantial deletions were made. The police refused to permit it showing in Providence, Rhode Island. Charlie Chaplin's satire on Hitler, the great dictator, was banned in Chicago, apparently out of deference to its large German population. The New York censors forbade the discussions in films of pregnancy, venereal disease, eugenics, birth control, abortion, illegitimacy, prostitution, miscegenation, and divorce. A member of the Chicago censor board rejected a film because it was immoral, corrupt, indecent, and against my religious principles. A police sergeant attached to the censor board explained, "Coarse language or anything that would be derogatory to the government, propaganda, is ruled out of foreign films. Nothing pink or red is allowed," he added. The police sergeant in charge of the censor unit has said, "Children should be allowed to see any movie that plays in Chicago. If a picture is objectionable for a child, it is objectionable, period." And this is but a smattering produced from limited research. Now, addressing myself briefly to the question why prior restraint is worse in the eyes of the court than subsequent punishment, I read again from the Times film dissent. The instant litigation has now consumed almost 3 years. This is the delay occasioned by the censor. This is the injury done to the free communication of ideas. This damage is not inflicted by the ordinary penalties. The threat of these penalties, intelligently applied, will ordinarily be sufficient to deter the exhibition of obscenity. However, if the exhibitor believes that his film is constitutionally protected, he will show the film, and if prosecuted under criminal statute, will have ready that defense. The perniciousness of a system of censorship is that the exhibitor's belief that his film is constitutionally protected is irrelevant. Once the censor has made his estimation that the film is bad and has refused to issue a permit, there is ordinarily no defense to a prosecution for showing the film without a license. Thus, the film is not shown, perhaps not for years and sometimes not ever. Moreover, more likely than not, the exhibitor will not pursue judicial remedies. His inclination may well be simply to capitulate rather than initiate a long and costly litigation. It is axiomatic that the stroke of the censor's pen or the cut of his scissor will be a less contemplated decision than will be the prosecutor's determination to prepare a criminal indictment. The standards of proof, the judicial safeguards afforded a criminal defendant, and the consequences of bringing such charges will all provoke the mature deliberation of the prosecutor. None of these hinder the quick judgment of the censor, the speedy determination to suppress. Finally, the fear of the censor by the composer of ideas acts as a substantial deterrent to the creation of new thoughts. As I said, I think this is really roughly where we are. Although I'm reading from a dissent, I think it has become the law as of 6 weeks ago, if not before that time. Procedurally, lest it be thought that this leads us nowhere and there's nothing whatever that can be done, I should point out that in this most recent decision, Friedman against Maryland, the court recommended a course of action by pointing out as a model for a censorship system the system presented to the court in the Kingsley Books case. Describing the system, it says, that procedure postpones any restraint against sale until a judicial determination of obscenity following notice and an adversary proceeding. The statute provides for a hearing one day after joinder of issue. The judge must hand down his decision within 2 days after termination of the hearing. So I think it is still possible by, by proceeding through courts rather than through administrative agencies to enjoin the distribution of obscene material. I withdraw that remark. Not to enjoin it, but to confiscate it within the narrow limits with which obscene material, I think, has come to be defined, namely as hardcore pornography. As you can see, this is a difficult problem, but I think it would be well to understand that its difficulty lies not with the incompetence of the court, which, as I found, is made up of relatively intelligent men. It lies rather with the inherent controversiality and perplexity of the problem. It's a problem involving definition and very fine distinctions, and when you have such a situation, you always run into difficulties. Once a young man who was trying to write a speech approached Benjamin Disraeli, who was then Prime Minister of England, and said, Mr. Disraeli, I'm having difficulty. I'm composing a speech, and I don't know how to make proper use of the words catastrophe and calamity. I wonder if you could help me. And Mr. Disraeli said that he thought he could. He said, this should give you some idea. I'm sure that you and I and the entire nation would think it a catastrophe if Mr. Gladstone were to fall into the Thames. On the other hand, I think that you, and I know that I, and many other people, would think it a calamity if anyone were ever to pull him out. Thank you very much.
I was asked to speak about the historic development of the present position of the American Civil Liberties Union on censorship of obscene material. I went to our files department in New York and asked for the history, and the history I got was only about 6 or 7 years old. And the reason for that, after doing a little bit of additional research, seems to be that it was not until a few years ago that the American Civil Liberties Union felt called upon to try to wrestle with the broad definitions about which we have just heard. The union, from the time it was founded in 1920, had taken the position that, of course, we will tolerate no political censorship, whatever, and had entered a number of the cases which were being brought to court with regard to censorship on grounds of sexual morality. But it had apparently taken the position that in each one of these cases, the material which was being offered for control did not fall within the definition of hardcore pornography. In other words, that there was socially redeeming importance in it, there was literary value, and that on these grounds, the material was protected by the First Amendment. That way of dealing with the issue, although it is satisfactory in the sense that you can enter each case as it arises through the courts and gets into national prominence, was felt to be inadequate about 5 years ago when we were reviewing the positions the union has been taking on a number of issues and came to this issue also. I think you will understand that this issue is one which is probably surrounded by more heat than any other, except perhaps the question of separation of church and state, somehow when we come to talk about morality, we get excited. And, of course, it's very proper that people feel deeply about the ultimate sanctions, the ultimate values by which they try to live their lives and by which they would like to have society live its life. But the problem in this area is not the right of people to make choices, but the attempt to impose on the whole of society standards which I or you or a group of people may feel should be imposed on society. And in the area of censorship, we have the only field of law, as far as I know, in which we attempt to regulate by statute people's thoughts, not their actions, but their thoughts. There's no other area in which we say that to induce bad thoughts in people is criminal. You can think about murdering anybody you want to. You can think about making H-bombs and dropping them on people. Children regularly engage in fantasies of destroying their parents and others in authority, and sometimes we don't grow out of that stage and we keep on thinking along those lines. As long as that thought does not proceed to action, there is no area of law in which we attempt to inhibit it, except in this area of censorship of pornography, where the court standard in the Roth decision is that the government may prevent by putting people in prison, or fining them, or exercising other sanctions of them, they are publishing material which causes bad thoughts in others. And the union finally said, it's not enough to argue case by case on the grounds of redeeming social value or literary value or what have you. We really ought to come to grips with this basic question. Is there anything that the government has the right to prohibit by law, merely because it induces bad thoughts, thoughts which we would prefer people didn't think, and others? And we came to the conclusion that that should be completely outside the realm of government authority. And therefore, the position which we adopted was that rather than our trying to add our bit of definition to the many which one may think of about hardcore pornography, that we cannot define where the core hardens or softens in pornography. All we can define is what may be validly made illegal. And we came to the conclusion that what we would propose is that that may be made illegal, which can be shown to immediately result in criminal acts and acts which violate laws. Now, no one has thought of passing a law against your thinking bad thoughts. They just pass a law against somebody providing you with material which might be a basis of contemplation which would produce these thoughts or what have you. But what we're saying is that the state has the right to prevent actions which are illegal, which are crimes, not to create a crime of publishing material, but to prevent antisocial acts of one citizen against another or of citizens against public authority. And if it can be shown that the particular material in question directly and immediately produces such antisocial acts, it may be validly prevented by state or government action. And that's where we stand now. Now, the additional question was asked, well, if you're saying, and we put this, to put it very precisely, if obscenity laws are invoked, prosecution should be based on clear proof that the material would cause, quote, an abnormal adult behavior which has validly been made criminal by statute, unquote. Now they said, well, that's all you're saying, a normal adult, but how about children? Isn't there a special protection to which our children are entitled by the government, since we as parents find it difficult to protect them? In this particular area, can we ask the government at least to take that job off our overburdened parental shoulders and protect them from material? And the union said, well, if you can show that the material is aimed towards a specialized group, whether they be children or scholars, and that this material will induce in them, in this specialized group, illegal acts, not thoughts, then the state may properly regulate it. In other words, if the material is being distributed at the junior high school level, and that's where it's really aimed, then what one must show is not, again, that it will induce these children to think bad things, but that it will induce them to actually do things which are illegal. And so similarly, for scholars, if you can show that the particular type of material will induce scholars to do things that are illegal, and otherwise the standards may vary with the group to which the material is directed, if it can be shown that it's especially geared or especially directed to a particular group. There's some people who feel that our position is disingenuous. That is, that if we really believe that anything goes, in the sense that nothing should be regulated in the realm of communication by the government, unless it is immediate incitement to illegal activity, why don't we just say so? And just say that in the realm of sexual morality, the government has no right to regulate communication. They may regulate marriage and actions of one kind or another, but not communication. Rather than putting the standard, which is obviously very difficult for any court to abide by, it is very hard, since all kinds of people disagree on what the cause and effect relationship is, to actually put on the prosecution the obligation to show that the act followed directly and immediately from the reading or the viewing is an almost impossible burden, and why don't we just come clean and say that we just don't think anything should be censored at all? I think there is some value in posing it this way, because I think it addresses itself to the concern of those who are pressing for censorship. It puts on then the obligation to meet our argument that before you can ask society to put people in prison or to confiscate material and burn it, you've got to really show that the evil which it may create, or which it is likely to create, is such as the state has the right to prevent. And if the evil is something that is in people's heads, and that you wish weren't there, that may be of deep concern to you and me, but it cannot be a concern of society, of the government, to make it illegal and to put people in prison for instigating it or aiding in people having bad thoughts. That's the position of the ACLU. Of course, on the enforcement level, we have had many things to say, because aside from the question of what is or is not obscene, the question constantly arises in all areas in which we are active of government attempts to shortcut the safeguards which the Supreme Court has placed around prosecutions of this type. That is either prior censorship or simply policemen walking into bookstores and tearing things off the shelves and throwing them on the street, instigating a general raid in an area where booksellers or magazine sellers are brought into court and charged with selling materials without any great, and no attempt to establish by legal action that the material is legally obscene, but just is obscene in the opinion of the policeman involved, or in the opinion of a private citizens group which calls upon the policeman to take such action, or which calls upon the mayor to establish a commission, such as we have in my hometown, New York. I understand you've had some problems with regard to that here in St. Paul also. But in New York City, the mayor has convened a group of clergymen and others to consider the question of obscenity in New York and to propose some action by the government to take. This group has issued various pronouncements on it. So far, I don't think that a statute has been passed particularly for the city. We do have state statutes regulating providing such materials to juveniles, although I believe that just recently, in effect, they have been invalidated by court decision. Very often, they're not content to use due process to have these matters adjudicated, but seek vigilante forms of pressure to enforce their morality upon the rest of society. And first of all, to get public officials to back them, because it's much easier to do these things if you have the support of the public authority. So that we have to deal with the matter on two levels. On one, the general educational level, perhaps to try to remove from people the fear that this is one of the great evils which society must have laws against, not to endorse in any way the publication of trash on any level of human discourse, but to try to convince society that the answer to the problem is in not just talking about higher standards, but in actually elevating the standards of taste to the point where this material becomes unprofitable and therefore is not produced.
This microphone seems a bit artificial in this small hall. I'm not sure that I need it, but since I have it, I'll try to get far enough away from it so that there won't be an echo. I'm supposed to speak on the topic of factors that argue for moderation in the ACLU point of view. I speak on this topic in spite of the fact that I'm a loyal member of ACLU. One of the things that I like about the organization is that we can have our differences and yet can unite in the support of liberty, and the differences that I have are well under control. Perhaps my role here is to remind us that we're talking about society, preferably a sane and a stable society, rather than about some subdivision or some part of it. ACLU official position says that the burden of proof ought to be on the government to show that any communication with which it wishes to interfere will produce in the individuals who receive it a criminal act. And it seems to me that it's worthwhile to say that as a guide to the effect of communication, science arrived on the scene only recently, and it is not adequate to the task or competent to do the job that the ACLU would impose upon it. In fact, I regard this statement as arising in the adversary context of the ACLU's legal approach to the problem. It is a game which is being played to put those of us who believe in moderation on the defensive. I hope that I can convince you that we shouldn't adopt that defensive attitude. And as far as law becoming the basic matrix of the mores, I feel that we all know that the mores were here first and that law has to occupy a secondary position. The information I hope to convey is that men have had to solve the problems arising from pornographic communication as best they could, without substantial aid from either science or law. Such wisdom as our civilization brings forward from its historical experience dictates special precautions with reference to pornography. More than 50 nations have entered into a compact to restrict and control the flow of communication that is sexually violent, that pictures and teaches the sensual, loveless, carnal rites of sexual intercourse as casually and as carefully as we teach our children to brush their teeth. All of the 50 states have laws that permit the legal examination of materials after publication to determine their fitness under the Constitution for general circulation. And certainly all I could advocate here would be examination prior, post-publication examination. I don't think that any of us has ever argued that the censor should sit down with the author and decide what can be published. In opposition to this evidence of historical wisdom, which has been accumulated through the trial and error experience of several civilizations over hundreds of years, we find pitted two forces. That is, we find arrayed in opposition two forces. First, the commercial purveyors of dirt for dirt's sake, the debasers for money of the ideal of love, and second, liberal spirits who, like ourselves, in enthusiasm for our own maturity and in confidence in our own self-discipline, imagine all families to be as well nourished, as well sheltered, instructed, loved, and controlled as our own. and thus always able to find the information and understanding needed to harness and contain the sex drive. Our liberal idea is that we can carry on an educational dialogue with dirt so that our children can be brought safely to maturity, and that in maturity, no person will have a prurient interest in sex or hardcore pornography. Against this liberal ideal, let us place the facts about the nature of our society, which are current in the discipline of sociology. I select a diagram here from Robert Cooley Angel's Free Society and Moral Crisis to demonstrate the nature of systematic study of social control. Now, Professor Cooley is a famous sociologist. He's a systematic student. The presence of the word moral in the title of his book arises from the fact that parents and significant other persons build moral norms into children in an effort to monitor behavior. The term moral norms arises descriptively from the conscience thus created. The pattern of moral behavior is derived in substantial part from the common values of the society, which are held in a loose but in effective consensus. So this diagram shows you the origin of all of our control system is the common values of the society. The ways in which we effectuate or in which we apply the sanctions dictated to us by these common values are through the moral norms. On the one hand, these are inculcated, these are internalized by the child through the teaching to the parents and significant others. Then institutions on the right hand, which have an existence of their own, an influence over the individual quite of their own. And then in the middle is law. Now, these three enforcing agencies provide social control, and it's in this context that I wish to speak. The pattern of moral behavior is derived in substantial part, let me repeat, from the common values of the society, which are held in a loose but effective consensus. And I don't think that the official statement of the ACLU is directed as clearly and as hopefully as it should be directed towards the maintenance of those common values. If you notice, when one reaches too far to the left in deviation from moral norms, he is considered a deviant. He is considered a person who has a special problem, a dangerous problem. He may even become a danger to society. On the other hand, the person who becomes disloyal to institutions may find himself ostracized or exiled from that institution because he becomes a danger to that institution and its career. The law, on the other hand, is simply an enforcer of moral norms or of the rules of the institutions. Institutions such as the state, the professions, the church, the factory, the family, the voluntary association appropriate to their own purposes the lives of individuals who are caught up in them. We have lately seen in the court dock prominent corporation executives who doubtless would not cheat at golf, but who entered price collusion agreements that enable them to steal from the general public in terms of millions of dollars. It is conflicts of this sort which we call upon law to help us handle, for law has to do the unpleasant work of reinforcing the discipline which, under our common values, is deemed necessary to a steady state. You can see from the diagram how Angel derives the concept of what is societally good on the one hand and what is societally bad on the other hand. And this is a concept which we can all understand and we can all use. It's not a concept which is enforced by any religious dogma. It's a concept enforced by our own consciences and our knowledge of what is required to have a steady state. That which is societally good contributes to a steady state. That which is societally bad contributes to the disintegration or the conflict or the breakup of the system, of the dynamic system which maintains that steady state. The steady state is one in which there is a high degree of correspondence between moral norms and behavior, when institutions and norms are compatible and adequate for control. When there is serious departure within society from moral norms, the phenomenon observed is deviation, as sexual deviation from the normative pattern, or as juvenile delinquency, or as extreme eccentricity in the mode of life. When there is a pattern of thought and action which tends to undermine institutions, we term the behavior as disloyalty. An action which tends to undermine institutions, and thus the person who plots the overthrow of the state by violence is termed disloyal. It's quite striking to me that in the pattern of the law, the Supreme Court has reached the same decision, for example, with reference to the Communist Party, that it's reached with reference to hardcore pornography. It has refused to allow the question to arise of whether or not the communist doctrine, the communist practice, has to result in overt acts before it allows interference, legal interference, with the organizational activities of the Communist Party. It is said that on the face of the evidence, they are conspiring to overthrow the government by force and by violence, and they've allowed interference with the political organization in violation, by the way, of the Constitution. And the same thing is true with reference to pornography. When they come to hardcore pornography, they draw a line which says, we will not wait for proof that this does produce overt criminal behavior. We will judge it on the basis of its tendency to do so. And by the way, the Supreme Court has rejected the clear and present danger test in dealing with pornography, just as it's rejected or restated it in dealing with the Communist Party in Dennis versus the United States. The way our society treats hardcore pornography is explained by the fact that such communication is linked in common experience both to deviation and to disloyalty. It is a violent attack upon the moral norms leading, according to historical wisdom, to disruptive or deviant behavior. It is subvention of such institutions as the family. The sick and unhealthy society is one in which the weight of deviant behavior tends to upset the balance between moral norms and institutions. Such behavior, in Angel's concept, is societally bad. Now, there are other important aspects of the diagram which we must ignore because of the shortage of time. We are concerned at the moment mainly with the normative value system. And so you might turn it off, Lynn, if you will, please. In the present state of social science, it is not possible to study definitively the elements of the moral web as we have described them here, and to determine precisely the effect of violent pornographic communication on our common life. This deficiency in science should not be read as an omen favorable to pornography. The latest literature on the general effects of communication, inadequate as it is, clearly supports the theory that damage occurs from pornography and that it is sufficiently grave that we are justified in providing calculated controls. We know that violence communicated by film or print triggers violence in frustrated children. We know that a child who enjoys a warm and solid home and a stable peer group relationship and who has no direct inheritance of mental illness is not likely to be affected by violent communication, as is the child who is significantly deprived. We know these things. The present state of constitutional law agrees with the theory of dangerous communication and asserts the necessity of control. Let me give you the short and simple case history of pornographic communication. The doctrine of Quinn versus Hicklin, 1868, a British case, was followed in this country until about 1933. It made children and deviant adults the standard by which to judge their probable effects of pornographic communication. This standard was abandoned in a series of cases beginning in 1933, and pornography was thereby divided into two classes. The first class, obscene communication, which children and normal adults in a healthy society must learn to live with, must learn to handle without stress, without serious stress. And second, hardcore pornography, deemed too violent in character to be tolerated and very unlikely to provide any lesson, any social lesson needed by the human heart. The new standard has been made national in scope, taking precedence over local law. All of us are exposed as a consequence to a swelling tide of obscene and pornographic communication, not necessarily the kind that can be stopped under the Constitution as presently interpreted. But this communication I'm talking to you about now, of the first class, was illegal in our country before 1933. and it is now protected by the Constitution. So there has been a very real liberalization of the Constitution, and we parents, we normal adults, are told that the Constitution newly places upon us the burden of preparing ourselves and our children for maturity more rapidly, more completely than ever before. We're told that rare and lovely art, which conveys a message of life worth learning, is sometimes found amid dirt, and that when seen in scabrous surroundings, it is made more significant by contrast by the unexpectedness of the discovery. The new national standard has left the moral norms of a great many persons uncovered, that is, unprotected by law. As a consequence, there is a considerable new private activity for the restoration of social controls. This is as it should be, for as long as private effort proceeds according to law, it is in itself a sign of the healthy state. The state must keep its institutions in repair. When those at the top impose standards unacceptable or inacceptable to those below, those which are in conflict with the common values, there must be a reconciliation. I doubt that the present directors of the American Civil Liberties Union correctly perceive the contemporary situation with respect to obscenity. As I repeat, I think they're playing an adversary game at law with the definitions involved here. It seems to me that the ACLU fought so long and valiantly against the doctrine of Queen versus Hicklin that it has not properly evaluated the changes resulting from nationalization of liberal values expressed in the Roth and Albers decisions. It appears to feel that the law has not changed. The law has changed, and so has our society as a consequence. We're all on the defensive now. It seems to me that by adopting an absolutist position, ACLU shirks an obligation to work for a reconciliation of the community's historical experience and the new constitutional libertarianism. The burden of facing all the facts with respect to social control should not be placed on sociologists, and will not so long as juries in our local communities are permitted to evaluate the effect of pornographic communication. I prefer to stick for the time being to the historical evidence as interpreted by the local juries, and to place their burden of proof about the serendipity of pornography on adherents of this new libertarian school.
I'd like to start out by reading a poem from Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass, because I think it is important. Sometimes the poet catches something that others of us do not. There was a child went forth every day, and the first object he looked up and received with wonder, pity, love, or dread, that object he became. And that object became part of him for the day, or a certain part of the day, or for many years, or stretching cycles of years. His own parents, he that hath fathered him, and she that conceived him in her womb and birthed him, they gave this child more of themselves than that. They gave him afterward every day. They and of them became part of him. Excuse me. The mother at home, quietly placing the dishes on the supper table. The mother with mild words, clean her cap and gown, a wholesome odor falling off her person and clothes as she walks by. The father, strong, self-sufficient, manly, mean, angered, unjust, the blow, the quick, loud word, the tight bargain, the crafty lure, the family usages, the language, the company, the furniture, the yearning and swelling heart, affection that will not be gainsaid, the sense of what is real, the thought if, after all, it should prove unreal. Men and women crowding fast in the streets, if they're not flashes and specks, what are they? The streets themselves, and the facades of houses and goods in the windows. These became part of that child who went forth every day, and who now goes, and will always go forth every day. Now, with this, I would like to make just a few brief comments. That obscenity and pornography is a primary causative factor in producing maladaptation or maladjustment or delinquent or antisocial behavior is an opinion that has been expressed many times. And I would remind us all that it is, as an opinion, it is an assumption. And unfortunately, in some assumptions, and much of our daily living is based on assumptions, but it seems to me that as I've listened to the discussion as it involves children, the stronger the person believes this assumption is a fact, the more strong feeling there is tied up in it, and this makes it difficult. Now, I would remind us that the influence of pornography and obscenity as being a primary causative factor in producing maladaptive behavior is an assumption. I would remind us further that there is no known reliable scientific studies to justify this assumption as a fact. And I would read from a paper recently published by Professor Berninghausen, director of our school, library school at the university, and one of his students, a Mr. Fonts. This paper was published in the Journal of Experimental Education in the winter of 1964. Its title is An Exploratory Study of Juvenile Delinquency and the Reading of Sensational Books. This is what Professor Berninghausen has to say. Over the last several years, Senate subcommittee hearings investigating juvenile delinquency have focused a great deal of attention on obscene literature. The conclusions the subcommittee has reached have been based largely on the testimony of expert opinion. Although the subcommittee did a good job of hunting for scientific studies aimed at discovering the relationships between obscene literature and behavior, their search was unfruitful. Such studies, for all practical decision-making purposes, did not exist. As recently as 1956, a note to the bibliography of a Senate interim report stated, quote, "There are no studies on the relationship of pornographic literature to sexual offense, although studies on pornographic literature and others on sex criminals occasionally have reference to the effect of such literature on the individual and on the sex deviate." Now, I could quote further, but I want to skip a bit here and read further from him explaining the reason for the lack of research in this area. He said, "The problem is a tough nut to crack. In view of the complex origins of delinquent behavior, the isolation of any single factor is difficult and perhaps impossible. There is probably no crucial experiment that will decide this issue. Only an accumulation of research over the years will enable us to arrive at a more definite picture than the one we have at present." And then he says, "This study is one step in that direction." Now, in medicine, though we cannot always base our work on scientific experimentation, which establishes fact, we do have something that we call clinical experience, on which we base some of our tasks. Now, the field of pediatrics, and child psychiatry, and clinical psychology have been interested in the maturation of children, the factors and the forces producing them, for now about 60 years in this country. And it is their job to study case by case the important factors that may be instrumental in producing one kind of behavior in one child, another kind of behavior in another child. Now, what is the experience as reflected in the writing of the seasoned persons who have had years and years of experience in dealing with deviant or children who present deviant behavior? An English pediatrician originally published one of the first books in 1919. I have a copy of the fourth edition, The Nervous Child. There isn't one reference to any influence of pornography, of obscenity, in the index that would give me a reference to where to look in the text. The same can be said of Dr. Morgan's book, A Clinical Psychologist. The Psychology of the Unadjusted School Child, which was published in 1924. We have here the textbook, which is now in its fourth edition, by Dr. Leo Connor, Professor Emeritus of Child Psychiatry of Johns Hopkins University, who published his original book in 1937. His fourth edition has just come out. There's not one reference based on his number of years of experience to suggest that obscenity or pornography are in any way a primary causative factor in the production of deviant behavior. Now, I'll not take up these other books. I'll just mention a few. The book that I read from first by Dr. Plant, Personality and the Culture Pattern, has no reference to it. This book was published in 1937. In 1948, Dr. Hale Shirley, professor of child psychiatry at Stanford University, wrote a book called Psychiatry for the Pediatrician. This book was completely rewritten and brought up to date in 1963. There's not one single reference to pornography or obscenity as being important causative factors in resulting in deviant behavior. Balkin and Balkin, pediatricians, wrote their original book, Clinical Management of the Behavioral Disorders of Children, in 1953. It was rewritten in 1960, not a single reference. And the last two that have been published, recent date, a book by Dr. Stella Chess and Dr. Stuart French. One, the first published in 1959, and the latter in 1960, likewise have not a single reference. Now, each one of the individuals that I've mentioned here are outstanding authorities in the field of child psychiatry, pediatrics, or clinical psychology. They come from many different backgrounds. They've had many, many different experiences. And yet, it would seem to me that if writing textbooks, pornography and obscenity was important in the production of deviant behavior, they, as educators, would be one of the first to call it to the attention of their students. I've been in the field of psychiatry for the last 30 years. Of those 30 years, 28 has been spent in dealing with troubled and troublesome children. And I would concur in what is reflected in the books that I've just mentioned. Based then on clinical experience and careful studies of thousands and thousands of cases, I think one is safe in saying that obscenity and pornography cannot be regarded as causative factors primarily producing deviant behavior. Nor are they contributing factors. Now, if we are really interested in our children and the welfare of our children, it would be more important for us to deal with things which need to be done and turn our attention to some of the things that we can do, and in doing them, perhaps will assure a better chance for children to mature in a more satisfactory way than some of them are at the present time. I would call your attention to a book that's recently come off the press, The Shook Up Generation by Harrison Salisbury. It was the headline-making book on juvenile delinquency and a Pulitzer Prize winner. One of the things that he says here, and I quote from him, "No, I think the origin of the shook-upness of our generation lies not in the international situation nor in the headlines of the tabloids. Such factors play no more than a secondary role. The source of disturbance is more prosaic. It lies in the home and in the community in which the youngster lives. It begins early in his life. It starts with lack of love and care and attention. There's nothing mysterious about it. In most cases, it can be detected years before the child's conduct has caused more than a trivial annoyance. Almost any good third-grade teacher can point out the youngsters who will be adolescent problems. The child who's cared for does not become shook up. He and his friends may form a gang. After all, man has banded into groups for social purposes since early in evolution, and animals do the same. But it will not be in an antisocial nature. Even if he lives in a bad neighborhood, the boy from a good family does not usually get into trouble except by chance due to gang activities in the vicinity. I agree with Mr. Singolani, who says from the depth of his own personal experience, and quoting, home is the root of 95% of the gang conduct and behavior problems. It is always true. If a kid doesn't get it at home, he goes to the street and gets it from the boys he finds there. When Mr. Singolani was 10, his older brother came home from a tuberculosis sanitarium. The brother got all the family's attention. My father and mother didn't bring me into the picture, he remembers. They didn't tell me my responsibility. They were just terribly worried my brother would have a relapse. This led me to the street, where the tough guys hang out. I had to be the toughest. It was the only way I could get any identity. The only way I could feel big was in the group. Whatever they did, I had to top it. No psychologist could give you a more succinct statement of cause and effect. I would call your attention to the tremendous shifts and changes that are taking place in our social order. It has been projected that by the year 2000, there will be 4 million people in the vicinity of the metropolitan area of Minneapolis and St. Paul, stretching out in a 7-county area. It is projected by the year 2000, over 50% of our population will be concentrated in 3 areas in this country. One running from Boston, Massachusetts, down to the neighborhood of Washington, D.C. The second from Chicago on up to Detroit and around the lower portion of the lake to Cleveland. And the third extending from San Diego, California to San Francisco and environs. What are we going to do with respect to planning Megatropolis? What in light of the horrible mistakes of city planners are we going to plan to make possible play, recreational areas, community centers, and so on, where children will have an opportunity to work off the raw animal energy that has to be worked off? What are we going to do about creating a more stable family life? It is a sad commentary on our society that 1 out of every 4 marriages ends in divorce, and the probabilities are that an additional family is broken but is staying together for some reason. And speaking from clinical experience, I can tell you that a situation like that has a devastating effect on the child as he struggles through the developmental years. What are we going to do about the dropouts? They can be spotted in the 2nd and the 3rd grade. Are we going to rest content to just let this problem continue to grow? Or are we going to find ways and means of providing the kind of curricula that children need to keep them in the educational system, and to provide monies to develop suitable curricula and train teachers and others. Mr. Salisbury has an interesting comment about what we can do. He says, and I quote, "There is a much closer relationship between adolescent delinquency and the child labor laws than is realized or willingly admitted by many social-minded people. These laws actually constitute a form of discrimination against the able-bodied boys who find it difficult to study and whose families are in dire need for their financial support." Now, what are we going to do about an extended use of our schools? Some places, they keep the kids in school until 5 o'clock in the afternoon rather than let them go through or let them out at 3:30. They do it to keep them busy, to keep them occupied, tire them out, as it's stated in one place. And in some instances, the schools are being more and more developed into community centers for activities that might provide constructive programming for children who otherwise might not have it. Well, it seems to me if we're interested in our children, their welfare and their future, which means our future, we ought to put first things first. There could be others mentioned. Now, I would just close by quoting Mr. Salisbury once more. "Since October 1957, we have begun to realize with great urgency that Russian technology is moving ahead of our own. We have found that Russia is, in some respects, doing a better job of training our young people and of mobilizing our human potentialities than we are. Some of us have become increasingly aware of the weight of population reserves which Russia can bring to bear in an extended contest for technological superiority, her population being about one-third larger than ours. Despite all this, few people have yet begun to correlate the wastage and the deterioration of youth which we permit on the streets of the big cities, on the highways outside the suburbs, and I would suspect in the quiet rural areas of the nation with our national defense potential. I think without running the figures through an IBM machine that it is not difficult to foresee that the day lies not far in the distance when we are going to need every young talent we possess, whether it be one of manual dexterity or mental agility, to bolster our technology, industry, science, and defense against the greatest challenges of the age. The most rapid possible liquidation of adolescent delinquency, an institution of a program to prevent its recurrence, is thus becoming a matter of national security. If we've not been interested in doing this job for moral reasons, we're going to be compelled to do it for the sheer sake of survival. So the sooner we get going, the better. We're coming up to the time when the juvenile delinquency will be a luxury, which we no longer can afford. There's no question but that we can end it. But the rehabilitation of the shook-up generation is going to require some changes in us as well as the adolescents. Reno, the boys from St. Augustine Chapel down in Henry Street, put it with simple eloquence when he said, if this present way of dealing with children or teenagers or kids, however you want to call them, is not changed to something with a little more respect to the fact that they are human beings, then this problem of juvenile delinquency will stay here and will plague this city for many, many, many years to come. If we wish our children to live in a humane world, we ourselves must practice the precepts of humanity. I don't know how many of you are acquainted with Gehiel Gibran's book, The Prophet, but I want to end with a statement that's made about children. And a woman who held a babe against her bosom said, speak to us of children. And he said, your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life longing for itself. They come through you, but not from you. And though they are with you, yet they belong not to you. You may give them your love, but not their thoughts. For you may give them your love, but not your thoughts. for they have their own thoughts. You may house their bodies, but not their souls, for their souls dwell in the house of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams. You may strive to be like them, but seek not to make them like you, for life goes not backward, nor tarries with yesterday. You are the arrows from which your children, as living arrows, are sent forth. The archer sees the mark upon the path of the infinite, and he bends you with his might that his arrows may go swift and far. Let your bending in the archer's hand be for gladness, for even as he loves the arrow that flies, he loves also the bow that is stable. I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, we ought to put first things first. Thank you.